If I had known there would be so many young people, I would have planned a little differently what to speak about. I was thinking to just continue with a wonderful section of Srimad Bhagavatam on devotional service, which is, I think, fine for the adults that are here. Maybe not so mesmerizing for the younger people that are here. Lord Kapila Dev is the speaker of this section of Srimad Bhagavatam. And a little bit about Lord Kapila Dev. Lord Kapila Dev appeared during Satya Yuga. Sometimes he's described as Yuga in the sense that at the very beginning of each of the four yugas, commonly, there's a form of the Lord who teaches the primary means for achieving spiritual perfection for that age. Just like Lord Chaitanya appeared very early in Kali Yuga, and he gave the Yuga Dharma, the chanting of the holy name. So in a similar way, Kapila Dev gave the Yuga Dharma for Satya Yuga, and I find it fascinating in that he's known for teaching Sankhya philosophy. Kapila Dev propounds Sankhya Yoga, and he's the Yuga avatar, so he certainly taught meditation, but here he is speaking about devotional service. Like three chapters of this section is on devotional service. Because meditation leads to devotional service, philosophy leads to devotional service, and everything in the whole of the yoga system leads to devotional service. And devotional service leads to pure devotional service. One needs to know what that is and how to do, needs proper guidance and direction. Needs proper means, but that's where it leads. In addition to sometimes being identified as the Yuga avatar, he's also identified as a Shaktyavesh avatar. Shaktyavesh generally, not always, indicates a Jiva as opposed to Vishnu Tattva form of the Lord who is empowered. And he's empowered with the Lord's Gyan Shakti. He propounds the Sankhya philosophy, which is very much in the Gyan department of knowledge. Thorough discernment of distinctions between matter and spirit. And then the distinction between the individual soul and the supreme soul. And then the acting within that relationship up to the stages of love of God. His complexion was white like snow, and his hair was golden in color, and he appeared very youthful in his countenance. Often in Prabhupada's writings, he's referred to as Devahuti Putra Kapila, the son of Devahuti, and of course Kardama Muni. And part of the reason is to distinguish from a more recent person than the Satya Yuga Kapila, who also went by the name Kapila, who propounded an atheistic Sankhya philosophy. Atheistic in the sense that distinctions of matter, varieties of matter, are described by the atheist Kapila, but no indication of what you do with that in terms of... That was to get everybody's attention. We saw some of you were falling asleep. So, Devahuti Putra Kapila, not only to surrender to the personality of Godhead, in speaking to his mother, Kapila Dev refers to himself as the personality of Godhead. And she also understood that he was the personality of Godhead. In fact, even before she was married, it was told to her husband-to-be, she didn't even know who her husband would be at that time, she was told to Kardama Muni that you will marry Devahuti. The Supreme, here's what happened. Kardama Muni was one of the direct sons of Lord Brahma. This is the very, very early stages of creation. So the universe is created. Lord Brahma needs to fill up the universe with living entities in the human species and other species. So after the four Kumaras, his first sons, declined that noble service, and then Lord Shiva appeared, 10 sons directly came from Lord Brahma's body as well, Swayambhuva Manu and Shatarupa. Very... Lord Brahma is not an ordinary personality from his own body. Just by mental strength, he would think of something and forms would appear. So the first of the 14 Manus appeared directly from his body along with his wife in a fully matured stage. And the combination of Swayambhuva Manu and, Shatarupa produced 3 daughters and 2 sons. The 2 sons are very famous. Uttanapada was the younger of the 2 brothers. Priyavrata was the elder. Uttanapada's son was Dhruva. And like, so that line from Uttanapada is described running through the 3rd and 4th cantos of the Bhagavatam. Then Priyavrata became the, emperor. But then there were 3 daughters, Devahuti, Prasuti, and Akuti, 3 daughters. So that the daughter, Devahuti's marriage with Kardama Muni is a subject matter in the 3rd canto. And her husband-to-be was selected by the princess. Devahuti was asked by her father, who would you like to marry? And a man who she had never met, never sent any text messages to, never saw his picture, you know, his attached file image of the person in his profile, just heard of him. And she heard of him from Narada Muni. Because Narada Muni knew of, certainly, Lord Brahma. He was one of Lord Brahma's sons. He's one of those 10 great sages. And Kardama Muni was requested by Lord Brahma. This is very early in Satya Yuga, and I need your assistance. Can you assist me by producing good offspring? So the arrangement was, he went first to the forest to perfect his life in devotion to Lord Vishnu. And he did. And in his, very similar to what happened with Dhruva, happened with Kardama Muni. Lord Vishnu appeared. while he was engaged in his process of meditation in the middle of the forest. Lord Vishnu descended on the back of Garuda, as he did with Dhruva, and he spoke. And he explained, Lord Vishnu explained, that you pleased me very much by your intense and very pure devotion to me. So I've come before you to fulfill your heart's desire. I know what your heart's desire is. You have parental affection for me. You wish to have me as your son. And so it shall be. I will appear as your son. Even before he got married, Lord Vishnu said, I will appear as your son. And to have me as your son, you'll require a wife, and in 2 or 3 days, she's going to come right here into the forest with her father. It makes it really easy to, like, not what happens normally these days. Lord Vishnu telling you who you're going to marry. She's going to come in 3 days. And with her father, he'll make a marriage proposal, and you should say yes. Okay. Yes, sir. And additional benedictions and explanations, like the roadmap of his life was already laid out. And sure enough, Swayambhuva Manu came a few days later into the middle of the forest. And this beautiful exchange between the two, where the emperor, he's the Kshatriya, came to visit the Brahmana. Now normally, the Kshatriya honors the Brahmana. But in this case, Kardama Muni, because he was receiving the guest, he first honored the Swayambhuva Manu, saying basically, you know, honoring his position of, because of your protection, those of us who are in the Brahminical order can carry out our duties very peacefully. And all of the other orders of society, because your virtue and your power and your strength. So, all glories to you and your service. And next, you come for some reason, whatever it is, the answer is yes. You come for some reason. The answer is yes. Now tell me, what is it you've come for? And Swayambhuva Manu, in turn, honors the Brahminical order, which is also perfectly appropriate, and in various ways honored the person and the order of Brahmanas. And then he explained his reason for coming. And I can see that you're a qualified person to take care of my beloved daughter. So that was like the marriage proposal. And Kardama Muni said, yes, on the condition that when there's the firstborn son who is elder enough, of age enough to look after your daughter, then I can return to my practices in the forest. Retire vanaprastha life. So that's standard, and Swayambhuva Manu agreed, Devahuti agreed. Right there in the forest, the marriage was performed. Because there was a whole entourage accompanying the king. And after some time, the king went back to the palace, feeling great separation from his daughter, naturally, but feeling confident of her being cared for. And Devahuti spent, this is Satya Yuga, the duration of life is much longer, multiply by 1,000. So if maximum duration of life in this age, more or less, is 100 years, then in the previous yuga, 1,000 years, 10,000 years, 100,000 years. So for tens of thousands of years, very faithfully, Devahuti just assisted her husband. It was her choice of husband And she was very happy to serve in that way, although she was accustomed to royal opulence. Her father was Emperor Swayambhuvamanu. She was accustomed to fine things. Now here she is living in the forest. So she became very lean and thin and matted hair and just a forest-dwelling princess, but very happy serving her husband. Then her husband, because you associate closely with someone, you come to know their heart, and he understood her heart, which was she wanted children. And so he, one fine day, spoke with her, "I understand this desire, and I'll make the arrangement. You've been very faithfully serving. Your highly qualified wife will provide you with children." So by his, he was not, here's a fourth qualification, or special qualification, I should say. He was a mystic, Kardama, pure devotee, a performer of meditation, and a mystic. So by his mystic power, he created a flying city with parks and trees and big palaces and roadways and everything. And in the palace, Devahuti was taken by assistants who made her look very nice instead of the, you know, the way that she was dressed and her keeping of her hair and so forth. So in a very beautiful, now decorated state, she and Kardamuni resided for some time, flying around here and there because it was an aerial city. And how many daughters were born? 9 daughters? 16? 9 daughters. Give or take a few. 9 daughters. And Lord Brahma came and they had a little festival and greeting Lord Brahma. And Lord Brahma indicated how pleased he was with his son, Kardama Muni. And he then indicated these 9 daughters of you and Devahuti should be given in marriage to the other sages present at the time, so that they, in combination with these qualified daughters, could help create praja to fill up the universe I just created. And then he indicated, just as Lord Vishnu had indicated, he indicated within the womb of Devahuti, she's now pregnant, a form of the Lord is there. So it was already known by Devahuti, that child was born. It wasn't an ordinary child. It was an incarnation of the Supreme Lord. And certainly, Kardama Muni had indicated as well. Lord Vishnu said, "He'll appear as our son." Brahma confirmed, "In your womb is a form of the Lord." And then Kapila Dev was born. And when Kapila Dev became of mature age to look after his mother, Kardama Muni left, as was promised by Swayambhuvamanu, and he returned to the forest in solitude. Which in one sense is a big mystery, because what's he going to meditate upon when he goes to the forest? The personality of Godhead, who is his son. He doesn't have to go meditate in the personality of Godhead in the forest. He's his son. He's his son, right there. Lord Kapila Dev. So it's a little mysterious. But in one sense, he was acting to yadyadacharati shrestas tat evi tororjana, acting to set example. And his son would become the Yuga Avatar, teaching the process of meditation. So he's setting the example for his son. In any case, he left. Now imagine the attachment that forms between husband and wife, loving husband, loving wife, qualified personalities. They become naturally attached to one another, and they had been together for tens of thousands of years. You know, so qualified that they have a personality Godhead as their son, how much attachment must have been there? And he's gone. So she was feeling great separation from her son. And so she approached Kapila Dev and made some requests. Primarily the request was, please instruct me how I can become free from this undue material attachment. Because, now I'm paraphrasing, I know the philosophy. I know I'm not this body. So, it's not that I don't know theoretically, but practically. The affinity on the platform of the body is very strong. This is something that happened with Priyavrata, again mentioning the two sons of Swayambhuva Manu. Priyavrata was the elder brother of Uttanapada. So when it was time for one of the two sons to become the successor to Swayambhuva Manu, naturally Priyavrata was approached. But Priyavrata said, I'm not inclined to become king and all of what's involved in being a king. My younger brother, he's very qualified. Invite him to become the king. I'd like your permission to go to the forest and perfect my life in devotion. So Swayambhuva Manu gave that permission, gave his blessings, and he went to the forest. And amazing description of how he lived and where he lived. This is Satya Yuga. It was like paradise in this celestial realm where he lived for the duration of many, 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 many generations of kings. He lived a very long time. And we find at the end of Canto 4, many kings have been listed in between. One of those kings, Prachinibari, he also went in the direction of no sons. His sons became perfected devotees, and there was no king successor to continue the line. So Swayambhuva Manu went to his elder son, Priyavrata, who was off in the forest in the celestial place, perfecting his life. He was already detached when he was younger. What to speak of generations of kings? Now he's no interest at all in worldly affairs. Approached by his father to become the emperor because there wasn't someone to do the service. He didn't want to say no to his father, but he didn't want to say yes either. Very interesting dynamic. So Narada Muni came. Now Narada Muni is the spiritual master of that line. But he's a sannyasi. He was thinking, he'll say, come to my brahmacharya ashram, this will be nice. But he didn't. Then Lord Brahma personally came, and he promised. He said, I understand your apprehension. If you take up this service of being the emperor, you'll have to have a queen. And if having a queen, you'll become attached. And your concern is, maybe you'll forget your spiritual practice. But I give you this benediction. As you continue through the course of this activity, you will not lose your Krishna consciousness. And sure enough, so he accepted the service. Sure enough, he became attached. Even after that, he became attached. But because he had the special benediction from Lord Brahma, on the other side of carrying out that service, he by that particular benediction of Lord Brahma, and he was able to continue in the conclusion of life, perfecting his devotional practice, and went back to Godhead. So here's now back to Devahuti. She had been with her husband for tens of thousands of years, serving him very faithfully and happily and everything. So she's very attached. So she's appealing to her son, addressing him as the personality of Godhead, saying, it's by your illusory potency that I'm now covered. So as you covered me with this illusory potency, you can take it away. So please take it away. Please instruct me so that I can live my life without this attachment. Really nice exchange. And that's the beginning part of chapter 25. And so the rest of chapter 25 is, and then 26 and 27 and 28 and 29 and 30 is Kapila Dev's extended answer to that wonderful question, which is important for all of us. How to live our lives in respectable way, carry out our duties of life without undue attachment. How are we to do that? Not the artificial kind of detachment, like just karma sannyas. Just give up your prescribed duties. That was the path that Arjuna was considering. I mean, very explicitly, because Arjuna was a Kshatriya, and he looked at what it would mean to carry out his duty as a Kshatriya on that battlefield, and what he saw was adharma. He saw bad consequences for the people on the battlefield and for himself. He was a sannyas. Just stop being a Kshatriya and go to the forest and live in a cave and be a mendicant instead of a Kshatriya. Read karma sannyas. That's one kind of renunciation. But Krishna said, no, not karma sannyas. Perform your prescribed duty. But don't be attached to the results. Karma nivadikaraste ma paleshu kadachana. Perform your prescribed duty, but don't be attached to the results. And set off the results to the Supreme. Karma yoga. And even higher. Become my devotee. Of course, he is his devotee. He was taking the position of one who had become forgetful. Like us. But Krishna is also teaching bhakti, and similarly, Kapila, an incarnation of Krishna, is teaching bhakti. So when Devahuti asked, please remove this covering of maya, I like this very much, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur said, Lord Kapila smiled, and he was thinking to himself, I don't know how he was thinking, how he knew what he was thinking, but he knew. Somehow he knew. He was thinking, Devahuti, why are you speaking like this? You're my mother, and I'm the personality of Godhead. You're a perfected devotee. You're not covered by maya. You're just speaking this way for some reason. It must be that you want to benefit others by hearing others hearing this instruction. You're always very compassionate, and so I'll answer your question. And he really answered his question, or her question. Seven chapters of Srimad Bhagavatam addressing that really important question in different dimensions, and that different dimensions start with how to overcome undue attachment by devotion to Krishna. By becoming attached to the Supreme, one can become detached from the temporary. Still perform your duty, but not in the mood of attachment. And how does that mood of devotion come into one's life, become awakened in one's life, flourish through association of devotees. I learned this from Dravida. Many of you know Dravida because he comes almost annually to Chicago for our Christmas festival. He was sharing with me, there's 8 verses that are known by our acharyas as sadhu sangastaka. Ashtaka means 8 verses, 8 stanzas. And all of them are glorifying sadhu sangha. So, who is a sadhu? How to identify the characteristics of a sadhu? What happens when a sadhu is met? What's the best way to interact with them? What's the fruit, the byproduct of that interaction? Very similar to the description of, let's say, of Narada, when he's describing to Vyasa in his previous life how he associated with the Bhaktivedantas, what that was like and what happened. They're very beautiful verses. Reaching to the stages of perfection through that simple beginning of association, and then doing the things with sadhus that sadhus do, bhajana kriya and so forth. And I'm not going to just do an overview but immediately following that chapter, there's fundamental principles of material nature. Chapter 26 is, that's the Sankhya. Categories of matter. We belong to the category of spirit. In that long, very, very complicated chapter, unless you're kind of like, have a science mind, you just want to skip over those chapters. They're so intricate and technical. In case you ever wanted to create a universe, there are the keys to tell you how to do so. How the universe unfolds from its subtle forms into the grosser forms of matter. All the elements needed for creation are there, and then over here is the animating factor of the soul. And then the chapter ends with the soul then meditating upon the Supreme Soul. It ends in meditation. Dhyan. And then how that meditation, the life, how to, a few householders here, how a householder should live their life in meditation upon the Supreme Lord. Very valuable, very practical instructions, beginning of chapter 27. And then that leads to, going very quickly, leads to a life of, it can, under proper guidance, can lead to a life of devotion to the Supreme Lord. So then that's chapter 28, and I'm going to be reading just one verse from chapter 29 on Kapila Dev's explanation of devotional service. We discussed one verse this morning, and we'll discuss the next verse. Something like describing the chamber or the atmosphere, the proper way in which one who has had sadhu sangha, has had association to devotees, and is engaged in the process of hearing and chanting, how to, that awakened spiritual consciousness, how to direct it so that you can live your lives in practical ways in this world of matter, and, you know, very, very complex. How to direct that devotional spirit or enthusiasm towards pleasing Krishna. So, this is Canto 3, chapter 29. And we'll read just one verse. Actually, two verses, 19 and 20. When one is fully qualified with all these transcendental attributes, we discussed the transcendental attributes this morning, characteristics of one whose life is elevated in consciousness. When one is fully qualified with all these transcendental attributes and his consciousness is thus completely purified, he is immediately attracted simply by hearing my name or hearing of my transcendental quality. So this is indicating a very advanced stage, beyond the stage of sadhana. We're all practicing devotional service. And the practices of devotional service are meant to purify the contaminated soul and elevate consciousness. There's another section, hasn't come up yet, but it will come, where Devahuti, after hearing all these nice glorifications about devotional service, the doubt that she has is, okay, it's the natural activity for the soul to be engaged in service to the Supreme Lord. But we're in this material atmosphere, and we've been in this material atmosphere for so long. She's not whining or complaining. She's just saying, is it really realistic? Like devotees will sometimes ask, is it really realistic? You can actually become free from matter? And Kapila is very firm. Yes. Not only you can, this bhakti is so powerful, it can dissolve the material mind and the false ego, which binds the living entity to those contaminations. Here comes the sun. You're pretty powerful. You can carry the sun around the room. Okay. So, in another place, Devahuti says, you've described devotional service very clearly, but what about these modes of nature? Devotional service is pure. Is it possible that devotional service can be mixed with the modes of nature? And Kapila Dev's reply is, devotional service is pure, but one's consciousness when rendering devotional service may not be pure. One's consciousness may be influenced by the modes of nature. So then there's devotional service that's influenced, the performer is influenced by the mode of ignorance, where they do devotional service to get some strength or power in order to destroy their enemy. Mode of ignorance. Mode of passion. They engage in devotional service. Specifically, he says, they worship the deity in order to get recognition or respect from others. Oh, here's this elevated pujari serving the deity. Honor and distinction and profit. And then there's devotional service in the mode of goodness, which we're encouraged to look toward or aspire for, where one engages in devotional service because there's the conviction, by so doing, I'll become purified. Then he says there's devotional service that's free from any taint of the modes of nature. And that is, as soon as there's, the characteristic is, as soon as there's the topics of Krishna, immediately the mind goes there, no effort. Just like the river flowing downstream in the rainy season. There's no effort required. Okay, you can go downstream now. Rushing downstream. So the mind just goes. No effort. It just goes to the topics of Krishna. So that's what this verse is. Another part of this whole section is saying the same thing. When one is fully qualified with all these transcendental attributes and his consciousness is thus completely purified, so that stage has been reached, he is immediately attracted simply by hearing my name or hearing of my transcendental quality. This spontaneous devotional service, not just chanting prescribed rounds. I mean, that's good to do. A little appreciation of Prabhupada's description of this. There's a, by now, very famous morning walk conversation with Srila Prabhupada in Nairobi, where, you may know, Prabhupada would each morning go for walks, and often they would go to a park or by a lake or some, you know, scene in nature. And a number of devotees would go. So when they were in Nairobi, one devotee was asking Prabhupada a question. Srila Prabhupada, how do we know when we're chanting in a quality way? And Prabhupada's reply was something like, there's no question, you must. And the devotee said, yeah, I know I must, but how do I know when the chanting is quality? And Prabhupada gave a similar answer. And then Brahmananda stepped in and said, yeah, Prabhupada, he knows that he must. He's chanting his rounds. I know this devotee. But he wants to know what's the difference between quality chanting and other kinds of chanting. Long question that Prabhupada gave. He said, when there's quality chanting, there's no question of 16 rounds. It's, you know, 60 million rounds. You just want to chant without counting. And in your present stage, under the order of the spiritual master, you must chant some prescribed number of rounds. You take vows to chant. And that's because that's the platform that you're on. Now these aren't Prabhupada's words, but I'm indicating his message that, when chanting is quality, there's no question of how many. No question of, you'll know that you're in the position of quality when the mind is just attracted and just want to chant. There's this description of, during the time of Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, Raghunath Das Goswami, and a few others that were residing in Radhakund. There was one Mataji that was living there. Name was Krishnapriya. And she was known as Radhakund Dasi because she lived there and she was just constantly chanting. One time she was attending a Bhagavatam discussion one morning. And the person who was speaking the Bhagavatam became very disturbed because she was continuously chanting during the Bhagavatam class. So he stopped this historical description. And he called her out. Said, how can you chant and hear the Bhagavatam at the same time? She said, no, I'm listening, but my tongue won't stop chanting. I could try grabbing a hold and holding my tongue, but it would still chant anyways. Now, the narration goes, that person was very proud of her answer, so he, in an angry mood, got up and stopped speaking and left. And from that moment, that person fell down, became a deviant, and so on, because he had offended such an elevated Vaishnavi. So the nature of this state that Kapila Deva is describing is in the purified state. Quality chanting is where there's no effort involved at all. The mind just goes, the tongue just goes. There's a spontaneous attraction. Not something that one can, you know, put on cosmetically. It's an indication of a state of purity. Attraction for Krishna. Attachment for Krishna. An attachment for the chanting of his holy name. Not just finding happiness, just compelled. Compelled like a miser for his money. Or Rupa Goswami describes it as the young boy, young girl in love with one another. They don't have to be told, now you should think of her. Mind just goes. Now you should think of him. The mind just goes. That's the spontaneous state. The mind just goes. With great enthusiasm. Next verse. As the chariot of air carries an aroma from its source and immediately catches the sense of smell, similarly, one who is constantly engaged in devotional service and Krishna consciousness can catch the super soul who is equally present everywhere. How do you catch the super soul? How do you catch the super soul? It's a phrase, it's a, so to speak, terminology. In one sense you can't, but in another sense he's everywhere. Just like Prahlad said to Hiranyakashipu, when asked by Hiranyakashipu, where are you getting your power? From the same place you are. From Lord Vishnu. No, Lord Vishnu. Where is this Lord Vishnu? He's everywhere. Oh! Is he in this pillar? So how do you catch the super soul? The imagery is given to help us understand, like air that's moving, wind, passes over some place that has some aroma, good or bad. And the wind, the moving air, catches that aroma and carries the aroma. So similarly, one who has come to this stage of spontaneous devotion, the mind, the Supreme Lord appears within the mind. That's what happened with Dhruva. He appeared in the mind of Dhruva. And then he appeared before him. In fact, that meditation of appearing within his mind broke, and then he was standing before him. Here's what Prabhupada writes. As a breeze carrying a pleasant fragrance from a garden of flowers at once kill, so one's consciousness saturated with devotion. Consciousness saturated with devotion. Now what saturated means, it's like, you know, a wet cloth that you've used to gather water, and it's, you can't gather more water because it's already totally saturated. So mind means it's so much filled with the mood of devotion. What's the mood of devotion? A desire to please Krishna. Love. Love supreme. Within one's life, whatever it is that we do, we're advised, we're instructed to do whatever we do for Krishna with devotion. when that becomes unrestricted by the modes of nature, or as the verse we were discussing this morning, the without any selfishness, what's in it for me consciousness? Nothing. Only the interest of Krishna consciousness. Saturated. When consciousness becomes saturated like that, one can capture the transcendental existence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who, in his Paramatma feature, is present everywhere, even in the heart of every living being. A few things. When you remember from the Dhruva Maharaj description, his meditation upon Super Soul was so profound that he was able to sustain his life air, and in his life air being so sustained, it was choked. The universe, demigods went to Lord Vishnu. We can't breathe. What's going on? Can you do something? Help. And Lord Vishnu said, don't worry, it's just a small boy, he's doing some meditation. And I'll appear there and take care of the situation. You can go back to your heavenly planets. So that same Supreme Lord, who was in the abode of Lord Vishnu, in Sweta Dweep, that one spiritual planet within this universe, that's where the demigods had gone. He already knew. And that same Supreme Lord appeared within the heart of Dhruva and then appeared before Dhruva. So which one was it? Lord Vishnu in his abode of Sweta Dweep, or Lord Vishnu who has appeared before? Does it mean he like left there and came here? Or that same Supreme Lord who was within then appeared before him, is it like three different Vishnus, or what is it? It's one Vishnu who's manifest unlimited expansions. You follow the question? Where's Lord Vishnu's abode anyways? He's in the heart, he's in the spiritual world, that's within an expansion within this material world, and he's standing before Dhruva. It's all three. It's like I remember reading, when I first started reading Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, and the description is there of Maharaj Parikshit. Uttara approached Krishna to request Krishna to protect the child in her womb from the Brahmastra weapon that Ashwatthama had fired. So she's standing before Krishna. Let that Brahmastra kill me, that's okay. Let the child be protected. So what did Krishna do? He expanded himself as the super soul, just big enough for Maharaj Parikshit to see and check the Brahmastra. And then after the Brahmastra was checked, he disappeared. So I remember pondering, where did that super soul come from? Was it Krishna expanded himself? That was one option. Or from the heart of Maharaj Parikshit, he expanded himself from the heart of Maharaj Parikshit standing before him. Or he came from somewhere. And then where did he go to afterwards? You know, college student, speculator, kid, wondering A, B, or C, or combination. And the simple answer is he didn't have to come from anywhere because he's everywhere. Same as Lord Srinadeva appearing from the pillar. He's not only in the pillar, he's everywhere. He didn't have to come from the pillar. He's restricted to the pillar. He's everywhere. Now what's that consciousness like? How do you meditate on Krishna who's everywhere? Head would spin. How do you do that? So the yogis, they meditate upon the form of the Lord in the heart, because he's also there. And for devotees, we meditate on perhaps the deity form of the Lord. Well, someone could argue, well, wait a minute, wood, stone, or metal? And then the answer was, who needs the deity? You can just, Krishna's everywhere. So if Krishna's everywhere, he's in the deity. And we're instructed to worship the deity form of the Lord and become attached to the deity form of the Lord. And through the deity form of the Lord, your relationship with Krishna can unfold, as with the name of the Supreme Lord. Your relationship with Krishna can unfold, the relationship of devotion. Just this afternoon, when we were in, wherever we were, Schaumburg, afterwards one of the people in the assembly came forward and said, when I chant, and sometimes just coming before the deity during arti, I start to feel this welling of an emotion and tears come from my eyes, and I don't know exactly what that is. Is it okay? I'm just a little extended. I was in, three times in China. We were just at a yoga center with some devotees that were kind of, you know, nice kirtan singers, not some special kirtan singers, and not the virtuoso type, just nice kirtan singers. And three times in three events, persons that had never had any contact with devotees or the Maha Mantra, asked the same question that this lady asked today. While we were having kirtan, this emotion came welling up in my heart, and I don't know what that was. And was I doing something wrong, or is it okay? Should I try to check it? Is it weird? Or these are people that never even heard the Maha Mantra, never heard Krishna's name. It's so powerful. So powerful. That which touches, when Krishna touches the heart moves. And when the heart moves, then all the things that are stuck in our conditioning has a chance to become dislodged and freed and move. So, what good fortune. And an anchor for those emotional moments, because then it's like, we're not doing something right unless that happens. That the action of the holy name is taking place in any case, whether it's the manifestation of that action is like this or that or the other thing. With faith, especially, if we go on hearing, as we're doing here, because the verse this morning was describing hearing his name or his qualities. Same in this verse. Just hearing the descriptions, all this nice description of Lord Kapiladeva and how he appeared as the son of Devahuti and Kardamuni. In one sense, it's just history. But in another sense, it's transcendental sound vibration, because it's in relation to the Supreme Lord. And by hearing, and even if we've heard again before, hear again and again and again, and it moves the heart. It makes the heart cleansed, and then awakens that dormant affinity for Krishna. What I said to the lady today, I wasn't free to say the same thing in a public forum in a yoga studio in China, but to the lady today, I said, take that emotion and direct the emotion towards my dear Lord Krishna, how to be best engaged in your service. Connect the emotion to the mood of service. And let the mood of service be nourished and grow. And whether that, if that emotion isn't there, same question is appropriate. My dear Lord Krishna, how can I, because that's what the Maha Mantra means. Please engage me in your service. Whether there's this feeling of emotion welling inside and bringing tears to the eyes or not. Let our lives, the soul, body, mind, and words be engaged in Krishna's service favorably. And hankering, aspiring for that is the practice stage And here it's describing the mature state, the spontaneous stage. And in this spontaneous stage, Krishna is attracted. Krishna is attracted by the love of his devotee. Krishna places himself at the disposal of his devotee. He makes himself not only available, but he desires the happiness of his devotee. He reciprocates with that love. That's the wind capturing the aroma idea. And the Supreme Lord is everywhere. He's accessible in any circumstance. The good times and the bad times alike. So that's just a little summary of Kapila Dev's teachings, and he goes on further and further. We'll explore it a little bit more tomorrow morning. Any questions or discussion? Anybody like to bring up? Yeah. Hare Krishna.
You mentioned about how important Sadhu Sangha is.
Yes.
Advancing in devotional service.
Yeah.
And I know you talked about it this morning too, but what should one's mindset be, or consciousness be going there in the association of non-devotees?
Let me make sure I understand your question. You get the idea of sadhu sangha, but you want to know about what do we do in terms of when there's non-devotees available, what are we supposed to do about that situation? What should the mindset be? Okay. Polite, but not intimate. In short. Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes about this because, are you familiar with Nectar of Instruction? A little bit? There are six qualities that can enhance bhakti and six qualities that can destroy bhakti. In both of those lists of six, association appears. And sangha tyagat sato vrate. One should give up the association of unwholesome persons. So now the world is filled with unwholesome persons. In school and in the workplace and in the marketplace and, you know, there's certainly good people and there's certainly unwholesome people. So know what to do. In school or in your moving about in the social circles of the world around you. The recommendation of Bhaktivinoda Thakur is to be polite. How are you? I'm fine. Oh, that's good. No, so social cordial exchanges, but not confidential exchanges. Confidential exchanges, he indicates specifically, is things that are personal in terms of direction of life, like, you know, what your values are and that which guides and rules and governs your life. So we should be respectful and cordial in our dealings. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu teaches one additional thing, and that is to desire or aspire, pray within the core of your heart to somehow be able to give the message of devotion to others. They may not be willing to receive, so you may not be able to give. But if that desire in that company is there, then there's protection. Just the desire to be an instrument of Lord Chaitanya is protection. Protection from Maya. That should be our mood. And it may or may not happen, but if you desire like that, Krishna will make some arrangements, at least some persons you'll be able to give. And it doesn't have to be, you know, some rah-rah or, you know, scolding or something. Just, you know, in a pleasant way, a principle, something that can help them in their lives. Something else? Oh.
I'm just thinking of the relationship of Devahuti and Lord Kapila there. Mm. And the question was very direct, and it was, you know, sort of...
Very genuine.
You know, genuine. And I was just thinking, what was the necessity in just seeing the final parts of the instructions of Lord Kapila there that you're discussing, that is so also so heart rendering. What was the necessity in between to have the whole description of the of
fundamental principles of material nature?
The Sangha philosophy that is more like, okay, it's interesting, but it's not really touching the hard part of, I'm assuming.
To say it a different way, for our purposes, if we don't understand all those things, and if we're not attracted to all those things, does that make us ineligible to go back to Godhead? Is it really essential for going back to Godhead? And if it's not really essential, why present it? We can go back to Godhead without understanding chapter 26 of Canto 3, Fundamental Principles of Material Nature. However, why is it presented? Do we have another harmonium? Another mridanga, okay. The whole of the Vedas, I mean, it's very, very deep and profound. Just like one of your gifts and attractions is music. Within the Vedic context, the science of music, raga, and what sounds can do for emotion and churning and stirring emotion and different ways of different instruments to create different emotions and how to mix them. It's very, 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 very deep and profound. Or any subject matter within the Vedas, medicine. Any subject matter, architecture, any subject matter, very, very deep and profound. So the science of the soul is also very deep and profound. And it can package very simply, like Bhagavad Gita, it's there. So why is it there? It helps one become very clearly situated in the side of, we belong with the category of spirit. So that should be enough. Just thanks a lot. And you know, why all this detailed knowledge? Because it's part of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is behind all of material nature. I mean, there are atheists in this world. And as far as they're concerned, there's no such thing as spirit. There's no such thing as God. There's no such thing as mind. All there is gross matter. So there's gross matter and there's subtle matter and there's the controller of both. So the paradigm of the science of transcendence is very, very profound and very deep and very detailed. As with anything else that's part of the Vedic wisdom, it's very, very deep and very profound. Fathomless practically. Where can you find the end? I mean, just say the same thing in a different way. From your training in music and, you know, the use of technology for creation of music, it fascinates you. For me, you know, I can't even begin to get my brain, you know, one fraction of an inch into that thing. But for you, it's, you know, it's music. And that there's a way to make wonderful music that way. Of course, there's ways to make wonderful music other ways and other ways and other ways, and that's all involved. It's a deep science. So, similarly, it's, you know, the notion that there's a, in the West, it's not a problem. In China, it's a problem for people to get their head around the idea that there's an absolute truth, or to speak of the absolute truth as a person. Everything comes from one source. They don't have a concept like that. So, supposing you want to persuade somebody, it's not just, you know, a sentiment. Here's the science of it. The push and the pull of matter unfolding into a cosmic manifestation. And then folding back up again. That's Canto 12. The withdrawal of the material energy. The unfolding of the material energy. The maintenance of the material energy and the withdrawal of the... And here's the science of it. And it's all resting on spirit. And it's not just a sentiment or a notion. Here's how it works. So some people have brains that are attracted to those things. Like you're attracted to music and certain ways of manifesting music. All that equipment in your home, that, I mean, you understand how it works, and not a lot of other people do. Sariputta was, you know Sariputta. Sariputta was lamenting that there was a period of time when Christian creationists were going around to universities, you know, teaching Genesis, you know, the first book of the Old Testament, the creationist, and like trying to convince. But, you know, they were harming the cause of theology because the very detailed kinds of questions that were being asked of them by the physics department and the science department people, they had no way to answer. But the Bhagavatam can answer it. If one becomes knowledgeable in these fields, then, you know, the physicist and the biologist and the chemist may say, well, wait a minute, you know, here's this and that. It's answered within this field of knowledge within the Vedas. It's compelling. Yeah.
In one sense, you know, what I'm understanding, what you try to, you know, explain about the question is that, in one sense, I'm trying to understand from the perspective of a Kali Yuga, you know, want to be the Bodhi type of mind, but there is, you know, Satya Yuga, pure devotee, mother of the personality of Godhead, you know, that have a much more, you know, a much greater capacity to dive into those type of, you know.
Well, even in Kali Yuga, look at what technology is doing. You know, the cause and effect, the push and a pull of matter, and what you can do with that. There it is, for persons with such capacity. There it is. Now, bad people use it for bad things. Same knowledge. I don't know the detail of how it worked, but my understanding is the persons that made the first atomic bomb figured it out from study of the Vedas. Movements of matter and you know, micro and macro scales. Anything else? Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, you described the different forms of devotional service, especially I was more focused on the devotional service in the mode of transcendence.
Mm.
I was trying to understand if there is any correlation between the 9 stages of bhakti, especially the advanced stages, and the devotional service in the mode of goodness and devotional service in the mode of transcendence.
Yeah. In the stage of attachment, asakti, that's one of the stages. Ruchi is taste, and following ruchi is asakti. And asakti is just before the bhava stage. So that's what's described here. When there's attachment, the stage of purification, freeing from the contaminations of matter, one becomes attached to spirit or attached to Krishna. Then when you hear the name or the glories of Krishna, because of attachment, the mind just goes. And that's the threshold of bhava, asakti. So it's similar to the stage that's freed from the modes of nature. Not motivated by or propelled by the desire to become purified or faith and conviction that I'll become purified by this. But just beyond that stage is attached. Spontaneously. Okay?
Is it a right statement to say, Maharaj, that devotional service in the mode of transcendence starts in the stage of...
Well, you could say that. It starts earlier. Also, you can say that. These are not just like buckets. You know? Not like that. It's gradations, and the gradations can glide down or up. Okay. Yes.
When Dhruva does the penance, when he stops eating and taking water time after time, nothing happens in the universe, right? So once he stops taking the breath, why all the universes, they can't breathe?
But it had to do with, because other yogis had that capacity. They would meditate just like Shobri Muni. He was meditating underwater. He wasn't breathing, didn't choke up the universe. It was the meditation upon the personality of Godhead. His meditation combined with that withholding of his breath resulted. Not only, you know, the universe became choked up, but his body became heavy, so much heavy that his toe was pressing the earth down. He became as heavy as the universe. Because of his meditation upon the personality of God, the intensity and completeness. It was more his being fixed upon Krishna than his, you know, suspending his life air. Because other yogis were able to do that. The strength of his Krishna consciousness, or his concentration upon the personality of Godhead, combined with that activity, gave special potency or capacity to what he was doing. Okay. Thank you very much. Prabhupada ki jai.
Yeah.